serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting a taste of some of the things unfolding in and around the island of Okinawa 75 years ago this week. You heard 1st Marine Division veteran Dale Anderson discussing some of the hazards faced by the young men fighting there. He was only 18 at the time. One of the other common injuries was self-inflicted, at least for those carrying the M1 Garand rifle.
Well, when you pull the breech of the M1 back and you insert a clip of 8 rounds of ammo, you push it down in there, and to get the breech to go forward, you have to kind of pull back with your thumb or your little finger, pull back on that and push down the ammo down in hard with your thumb, and as you let go of the breech, it will move forward, locking it in. If you don't get your thumb out of there, it'll smash your thumb. And that's what you call M1 thumb. They showed us that in boot camp, but when we were up on the firing line, several of the fellas got that because they didn't get their thumb out of the way fast enough. Talking about the M1, when the last round was fired from the clip would spring out, and it makes a very familiar sound as it springs out. And the Japanese were aware of that sound, and they knew you had to get a new clip in your weapon. And so when they heard that sound, they would take advantage of that and try to attack you before you could get another clip in your weapon. The island had a lot of big caves. There was a lot of bags of black powder ammo left around from that. And as we would go out on patrol, one day we were walking down this dirt road, and there was sugarcane on each side of the road. Sugarcane was up about 5 feet high, and we would always walk about 8 feet apart in case somebody lobbed a grenade over into our ranks. It wouldn't kill that many. One day, this Sergeant Ferguson, he carried a 30 caliber carbine. He just turned and fired, and about a few seconds after he fired, we heard this thud. Just after we heard the thud, here came pieces of blood and guts and everything and landed on us, and we didn't realize what had happened real soon, but Fergie said a Japanese had raised up ready to throw a grenade over in our ranks, and that's when he saw him and he shot him. The Japanese fell, and when he fell, his grenade went off, and that's what threw that blood and guts all up around over us. We went on down from there. This same sergeant, now where it was grass on each side of the road, high grass, about almost 3 feet high, and there was a dry canal running down along, and there was a big willow tree down on the side of that. As we approached that willow tree, Fergie just turned and fired in the grass, again with his 30 caliber. He had sharp eyes, but he turned and fired, and a woman fell out. He had shot her right down through the top of the head. All he saw was black hair at the time he shot. He didn't know it was a woman, but he shot her right down through the top of the head, and the bullet came out her left cheek, blew it out. And just almost immediately after that, two big Japanese was running down this dry canal. Of course, they were both killed almost immediately. Then we went up to the tree and went down, and there was a cave about 3 or 4 feet in diameter. And if you came to a cave that had flies flying around the mouth of it, you knew it was occupied. We had a Okinawan that was friendly to us that we took along as an interpreter. So we sent him into the cave to see if there was anybody in there to try to get him to surrender and come out. And in just a little bit, this old grandma, she must have been 80 or better, and about a 10-year-old girl came out. Of course, they both had their hands up. The little 10-year-old girl had this little doll in her hand. And she bowed and she held out the doll to me, and I made the motion that I didn't want it, But she did it again, so I took this little doll, and I've had it all these years. They were sent to a repatriation holding camp, but it's hard memories.
When you saw a grandmother and a little girl handing you a doll, did that alter your perspective or put more of a human face on what was going on there on Okinawa?
We knew they couldn't hurt us, or we didn't think they could hurt us, so we were sympathetic toward them because we figured it was probably a whole family that had been wiped out that day. This was probably the grandmother, and the first lady that Fergie killed was probably the mama of the little girl, and then the two was running down the ditch that got killed. They were probably her sons or her brother, and so it was a whole family that was probably wiped out that day. That's just hard when you think back on it.
Yeah, it seems like that's part of the explanation of what you said earlier, that you hope there's never another war like the one you guys were in.
Yes, sure is.
So this Battle of Okinawa, the last major land battle of World War II, did you have any kind of inkling when it was winding down that things might be over for you soon?
No, we were still preparing for mainland Japan, and we were all dreading that battle. Even though we were Marines, we were dreading the Battle of mainland Japan because the way Iwo Jima had been fortified and Okinawa had been fortified, we knew mainland Japan was going to be really, really bad. I always had to hand it to President Truman at the time for making the hard decision to drop the atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That was a mighty hard decision he had to make.
By mid-August, Japan is surrendering, and you guys don't have to go over there, and I imagine you Marines celebrated just a little bit.
Yeah, we celebrated a lot with some Japanese sake. One kind of fun thing that we had, it was July, the island was secured, so I had brought in a bag of this black powder with granules about the size of your index fingernail. I decided I'd have a little fun. Of course, we were drinking a little sake at the time, too.
This wasn't just being stupid. You knew how to work with black powder from your days blowing up giant trees in the forest for lumber back before the war, right?
That's right. Yes, we did. I'd had some experience with black powder and dynamite. And we used to buy our dynamite from a place there in Orange Cove. I think the little building is still there where they kept the dynamite out back.
So when the 4th of July rolls around on Okinawa, you want to celebrate like all your fellow Americans back home. You find some black powder. What kind of fireworks did you produce, and how'd you pull it off?
Well, I found a pipe, a 3/4-inch pipe, about 3 feet long. We were bivouacked right along a river there, and so I stuck this end of this pipe down in the edge of the bank, kind of pointed it out over the river, and filled it with black powder and whittled me out a wooden plug to go in it, but I didn't have a fuse. I didn't have a way to set it off. And it was getting toward dusk. I looked over about 100 feet or so, and we saw a column of gnats about 4 foot high and about a foot around that was just static. And I thought, well, that's strange to hear, to see gnats flying around in a static position. So I said, well, let's go investigate. So a couple of buddies and I, we went over. It was an old house that had been all blown to pieces. We threw back some boards. Here was a big crock with about an 8-inch mouth on it, and it was almost 3 feet deep, buried in the ground. And of course, these gnats were flying right over the top of that. And I got to thinking, well, I know gnats like vinegar, so maybe it's a jug of vinegar. So I took my canteen cup and dipped down in it and smelled of it. Don't smell too bad. So I tasted of it. Ooh, it even tastes even better. So it was a whole jug of Japanese sake. So I filled both canteens. Of course, the canteens were aluminum back then. I filled both canteens, went back to camp, tore off a piece of my shirt, dipped it down in it, stuck it down in the pipe, let the end of it come over and stuck a match to it, and it burnt down in that black powder, and those big granules of black powder came out over that river just real pretty, nice.
Lit up the sky?
Lit up the sky. And I was getting ready to load up again. I kind of looked down by where the pipe was, and I saw these two shoes. They must have been size 14 or 16. They were, I think, the biggest boots I'd ever seen. And I slowly looked up, and it was a captain. He said, Anderson, what are you trying to do? And I said, oh, I'm just have a little fun, sir. It's 4th of July. And he said, your fun is over. He said, we thought we were under, the officers were bivouacked upon the hill. And he said, we thought we were under attack again. So you quit that. So the next day, we were out on patrol, and I decided I'd have a drink of water out of my canteen that I'd filled last night. And so as I pulled that aluminum canteen out of the canteen cup, the whole bottom of that canteen came off. It was just disintegrated from that Japanese sake. And so you can imagine what it would do to your stomach.
Exactly. And I hope none of you listening got any 4th of July ideas from what he did on Okinawa 75 years ago. After occupation duty in China, Dale Anderson finally got to come back to the States. But that journey was not without incident either.
We hit a typhoon coming out of the Yellow Sea there in China, and I always got seasick the first couple days out. I'd get terribly sick, and that day I was so sick I didn't care whether I lived or died. It was just so sick, and they'd put us back on the aft of the ship, and there was about 20 of us back here in the same condition, and we were just sliding back and forth in our own vomit or in everybody's vomit, and they'd come along about every hour with a big fire hose and hose us down. The ship was listing so much, and if it had another 2 degrees of list, it would have probably sunk. It took us 21 days to come home nonstop. Going over, we went over on the USS Pickaway, which was a troop transport. It wasn't a real large ship. As we sailed around Hawaii coming home, we were on our last leg of the journey. It was beautiful moonlight nights, and the porpoises were running along the ship, jumping. I remember that as the most enjoyable time of my service was on the way home. I left San Diego and I came back to San Diego.
And grew up quite a bit in between after going over as a teenager. When you think back about your time in the service, and you mentioned earlier how important it is to you that this history is not lost and that that your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids know what happened then, what would you share with the rest of us that you think we ought to know and remember about World War II and the men who served in that time?
I would like to see every able-bodied young man and young lady go through Marine Corps boot camp or a boot camp, and just remember that war is hell. There's no glory in war, and when you see your friends and your buddies killed and wounded and maimed, just remember that, as the old saying is, I think history can repeat itself. We don't want to ever repeat World War II in our nation. And so do your part in keeping America strong and safe. I came home from the war all one piece and went up to Mineral King, which is east of Visalia, and started logging up at Silver City, and got between two logs end to end, mashed my knee. They took me to Fresno Community Hospital and waited 10 days and amputated below the knee, trying to save the knee, and that didn't work, so they waited another 10 days and amputated above the knee. Still didn't hit enough blood, they thought, and they were going to have to go higher. And that night I promised God that if he'd let me keep that much leg, that I would faithfully serve him, and I've tried to do that through these 60 some odd years. But that's how I lost my leg.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it occurs to me that maybe that circumstance that could be really devastating for a lot of people, and I'm sure was really challenging for you, maybe your experience in the war and the things you had to deal with as a young Marine prepared you for going through something that severe?
Yes, because this injury to me wasn't near as severe as some that I had seen during the war. And so I felt myself really lucky, or maybe blessed, that that's all that happened to me, that I just lost a leg.
Remember when I said that we can gain some powerful perspective when we listen to these stories and what some of these Americans were dealing with 75 years ago? I don't know about you, but that's exactly what happened for me today. If you would like to link to the full-length original interviews with the two veterans whose memories you heard today, you can do that at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.